Calling all AMS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is aiming to renew its optional student fee at referendum this fall. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more. Watch your emails for ballots from the AMS and vote yes for CFRC's fee increase on November 12th, 13th, and 14th. Your voice, your station, your vote. Thank you for your support.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, the queer subconscious mind. That next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada, as well as being a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So, today, the queer subconscious mind. And here to talk all about the queer subconscious mind is queer relationship coach and rapid transformational therapist practitioner, or RTT, Lanae Halloum, who joins me to talk about helping LGBTQ plus individuals break free from toxic or unhealthy relationship patterns, fears of abandonment, rejection, and feelings of not being enough. We'll talk about all of those things, including rapid transformational therapy. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. But our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning writer, professor, and playwright Patrick Horrigan reads from his novel, American Scholar. A novel that tells the story of a man driven to discover, but afraid to know the truth about himself and his gay loves, past and present.
James Fitzgerald would no more part with those 12 storage boxes than cut off his right arm, for they contained all that was left of Gregory, in a material sense anyway. His files on lesbian and gay activism, articles on non-monogamy and queer theory, Marxism and feminism, his college notebooks, journals, essay drafts, old newspapers and magazines, flyers and pamphlets, song lists from his DJ days, everything to do with the gay study group at Columbia, not to mention record albums, cassette tapes, books, letters, items of clothing, his stash of political campaign buttons, a veritable time capsule of his life and the life they shared in New York in the 1980s. every couple of months, Fran would mention the boxes, how they took up so much space in the spare room, how he wished they could turn it into a proper guest bedroom, or maybe even a nursery. That was the real issue, not the boxes. The boxes weren't in anybody's way. The real issue was children. Fran wanted a child by the time he was 40, and the drumbeat had only gotten more insistent since he turned 38. James didn't want children. "My books are my children," he sometimes said. "Well, I'm sorry, your books aren't enough for me," Fran would shoot back. They quarreled about it again this morning, and on the very day he was set to give a reading from American Scholar. Surely that was no coincidence. The buzz in the Warburg Lounge grew louder as the time approached. James had sequestered himself in the tiny office at the back of the lounge to look over his notes and some passages from the book. He never liked interacting with people before a talk or a class because it blew his concentration. Fran, meanwhile, was nowhere to be seen. James tried calling one more time. Still no answer. They'd originally planned on going uptown together, but that afternoon Fran texted saying he had to work late and would meet him at the Y instead. Now, minutes before the reading, he sent a message that the 7 train was delayed. So which was it? Too much work or subway trouble? Why not jump into a taxi or call an Uber? It didn't take a PhD in English to see what was going on. Of course he loved Fran and wanted him to be happy, wanted to do what he could to make him happy if it were possible. But raising a child, the sacrifice, the expense, the headache and heartache, he just couldn't fathom. The idea of being married wasn't even something he imagined for himself until a few years ago, much less being a parent. Maybe if he were younger, like Fran, he might feel different. But he was 54. He liked his life the way it was. His path, he believed, was set. He was already working on his next book, a series of personal and scholarly essays on place, from the house he grew up in to the home he'd made with Fran, along with some famous attics, rooms, and houses, both real and fictional, in between. And he could dimly see 2 or 3 more writing projects on the horizon. He took a deep breath. People had come to hear him speak about American Scholar, friends and colleagues and students and people he didn't even know. Getting tangled in a marital spat was the last thing he wanted at this moment. He stood up, silenced his phone, and slipped it into his pocket. Now, with book, notepad, and lucky silver cross pen in hand, he entered the lounge. "Anyway, who knows?" he thought. "Maybe Fran will make it in time for the reception." Jimmy Fitzgerald entered the shift room of Earl Hall and took a quick look around. He felt nervous. 15 or 20 guys stood talking in small groups and pairs. Others sat in folding chairs arranged in a wide circle. Though many of the seats were already taken, he spotted 3 in a row still unoccupied. He crossed the room, trying to act like he knew what he was doing, like he belonged here, and chose the middle of the 3 so as not to have to sit next to anyone, at least not yet. Avoiding all eye contact, he methodically removed his coat and scarf and hung them over the back of the chair. He withdrew the book along with a notepad from his backpack and placed them on his lap. He dug through an inside pocket until he found his lucky silver cross pen, his favorite, a graduation present from his grandmother. Now, he wanted another moment to get comfortable, just take in his surroundings. The room was handsome. High ceiling, chandelier, deep-set arched windows with long drapes, dark wooden wainscoting, marble fireplace, an enormous Persian carpet. He took a deep breath. The buzz in the room grew louder as the hour approached. He wasn't ready to interact. At the same time, he wished he were any one of these guys now boisterously laughing and talking with friends. But of course, that's why he'd come in the first place. After living in New York for 2 years with hardly any social life to speak of, and since the breakup with Andy, virtually no romantic life. What he needed was friends, like-minded, openly gay friends. The gay study group at Columbia promised to be the answer to his prayers. The chatter in the room died down as Gregory called the group to order. Welcome to the gay study group at Columbia. My name is Gregory Lenda. Most of you know me. By day, I'm the bookkeeper for Democratic Socialists of America, and by night, I'm the organizer of this group. I started it 3 years ago with Bill, and he gestured with his elbow to a cute, muscular guy with enormous eyes and long sideburns sitting directly to his right. Hi, hi, Bill said, waving his hand, when we were seniors here at Columbia. At the time, we felt there was very little sense of community among gay men on campus. The big gay dance on the first Friday of every month was about the only formal event that brought people together. Otherwise, everybody would leave campus with their friends and head downtown to drink and dance. And don't get me wrong, he and Bill turned momentarily to look at each other. We love to drink and dance, but we thought there needed to be another way for gay men to get to know one another and also to learn about the community's history and politics, because I personally think the AIDS crisis has made it more urgent than ever to know who we are and where we're going. There's a lot of people out there right now trying to use this epidemic against us and turn back the clock on gay liberation. So that's why Bill and I created the study group, with the blessing and financial support of Student Activities. He clasped his hands in prayer. Thank you, Student Activities. And I'm proud to say our membership has been growing steadily ever since. I want to give a special welcome to the newcomers tonight. You mind just raising your hands so we know who you are? Jimmy, along with a handful of others, raised his hand. That's great. Welcome. So tonight, Bill's going to give a brief introduction to the book, and I'll facilitate the discussion. And then we have a surprise plan for you, so make sure you stick around. Then, as if Gregory were a news anchor, and take it away, Bill. First, I want to thank Gregory, Bill said, gently placing a hand on Gregory's knee, for making all of this possible. It's really good to be here. You all didn't see too much of me last year because I was studying to become a Quaker. This elicited a few ohs and wows from the group. He laughed and withdrew his hand from Gregory's knee. It's because of my boyfriend. He's a Quaker. Which reminds me, at some point, I'd like us to tackle religious ideas about homosexuality, maybe next semester. I think it would be great if we could, you know, take some ownership of that discourse, which is so often used against us. Just putting that out there. So this is how gay men talk, Jimmy thought, looking at Gregory and Bill, admiring their easy eloquence, envying their subtle camaraderie. He and Andy never had that tenderness with each other. This is the sound of their voices. This is how they comport themselves when sex is not top of mind. Gregory smiled. Being with you last night reminded me how good I used to feel with you. Me too. Jimmy felt the stirring of an erection. And how I used to feel I could tell you anything and you wouldn't judge me. I want you to feel that way. I know you never stopped caring about me. I never stopped, you're right, it's just, I know. You're the first real boyfriend I ever had and I always, Jimmy paused to collect his thoughts. I have so much to learn about being in a relationship, but you are very important to me. You have no idea. I'm glad, Gregory said, sipping his beer. So I feel I can tell you, I recently got tested again for HIV. Jimmy tensed up. And I'm happy to report the test came out negative. Oh, shit, are you trying to scare me? Imagine how I felt having to wait for the results. Was there any doubt? Gregory leaned back. There's always doubt. No, but I mean, did you really think you might be HIV positive? Yes. Why? Because the virus is out there and any one of us... No, seriously, have you had unsafe sex? Are you interrogating me? I think I have a vested interest in knowing whether a friend has been having unsafe sex. Well, I prefer to say safer, because you really never know. people get a false sense of security or doom with words like safe and unsafe. It's not that simple and clear cut. Jimmy stared in disbelief. Sometimes you use a condom and there could be a tear you're not aware of, or you have foreplay and a drop of Gregory. James, you need to keep it down, he said quietly but forcefully. The warmth had gone out of his voice. Most people say you can't get it from cocksucking, and in the anal department, I only finger fucked you, so you're fine. It's not me I'm worried about. I'm only telling you this because I wanted to celebrate the fact that I'm HIV negative, one day at a time, you know? You said you wanted to know my status, so I'm telling you. One day at a time? Are you nuts? The waitress arrived with their burgers. Anything else I can get you? No, just the check, Gregory said. She raised her eyebrows. Okay, gotcha. Gregory took out his sunglass case and threw it down on the table. What are you doing? I thought you would understand. He put on the sunglasses and tossed the case back into his bag. Jimmy pushed his plate aside. You're telling me you're having unsafe sex. I'm telling you I'm HIV negative. You must think I'm an idiot. I don't appreciate being scolded. He slung his backpack over one shoulder and slid out of the booth. Where are you going? I need some air. As Gregory walked out of the bar, Jimmy made eye contact with the bartender, who appeared to have been eavesdropping on their argument. The waitress returned with the check. Your friend coming back? Jimmy let out a soft laugh. He thought of an excuse that wouldn't sound embarrassing. Then he dismissed it. I don't know. You want me to wrap it up? She asked, clearly bewildered by Gregory's sudden departure. I don't know. No, I'm sorry. He won't be back. I don't know. You'll be paying for it, right? She said with a frown. Jimmy looked at her, then the exit. Yeah, he thought. I'll be paying for everything.
Up next, the queer subconscious mind.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Lanie Halum, hello, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Am I saying your name correctly, Lanie Halum?
It's Lanie Halum.
From your lips to God's ears. I have to say thank you so much for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this. You are a queer relationship coach. You are a RTT, a rapid transformational therapist. Let's start there. Rapid transformational therapist. Talk to me about what this means and what this entails, being a rapid transformational therapist.
Yeah, sure. So rapid transformational therapy, or RTT, is based on hypnotherapy. I actually don't like to call it hypnosis because there's a lot of stigma around that. and usually it's just like a really deep state of meditation. You're still in control and everything. But the idea of it is to relax the conscious mind more so that there is easier access to the subconscious mind. And then the mind is more suggestible to recall past memories. So we go back to the past to find out like about the root cause of whatever we're dealing with. So the presenting problem or limitation or feeling that you would like to work on. So it works on the basis of going back to the past, finding the root cause. When this understanding is gained, then it's easier to let it go. Like once you understand a problem, it's easier to fix, right? And then installing a new belief system. So with different tools, different methods. It's based on neuroscience because usually there's a recording afterwards with a like new belief system or like the new belief that you would like to have instead of the limiting belief that that was causing the issue or the limitation and or holding you back. And this recording has to be listened to for at least 3 weeks or 21 days. And that is based on neuroscience because according to neuroscience, for one thought to become permanent in the mind, so it becomes like part of your belief system, it has to be persistent for at least 3 weeks. And that's how the neural pathways are formed, because every day there's like maybe thousands of neural pathways formed from each single idea. But the mind like refreshes that and takes like removes all these temporary neural pathways overnight when we sleep. But then if there's one persistent thought that is happening every day, then the mind just keeps, that neural pathway becomes permanent in the brain. Mm-hmm. And that's how the whole methodology works.
I've heard that to do something and to have like a new, habit or a new whatever it might be, let's say you're working out, you have to sort of do that thing when you first start it for a certain period of time, whether it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever, for it to then become part of you. And or part is that the same sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. It is exactly the same thing, and that is also exactly how like the psychology behind advertisements work. So when we see all these billboards and online advertisements and we keep seeing it over and over again, then even if we are annoyed by this advertisement, but when we go to the store and we spot it, we're like, oh, this is it. Like, this must be good because it became part of our kind of belief system, if mm-hmm. I want to have go that far with expressing that.
So I'm based in Toronto. You're based in where? In Germany?
In Hamburg, Germany, yes.
So you're based there, and your clientele is primarily members of the LGBT community. And is this something that is effective to do virtually then? When you're, say, you know, for lack of better words, you're doing, you know, hypnotherapy. Is this something that is effective when you're doing it virtually compared to in person?
Yes, there's no difference at all. So yeah, like actually I only work online, and I've also done RTT therapy. Like I went to RTT therapists myself, and I have done this mainly online. I actually even prefer it, especially when it comes to heavy emotional work, because usually an RTT session goes on for about 1.5 hours or maybe sometimes even 2 hours. And then there's a lot of emotions that come up, a lot of emotional work. So afterwards, I was very happy that I was cozy at home and I can just go to bed and take a nap, better than being outside and having to deal with driving or public transport or whatever people use. So yeah, it works exactly the same as if it's in person.
So one of the topics that you tend to deal with is rejection, and essentially how rejection plays out in our romantic lives and our dating lives. Can you talk to me about that when it comes to rejection and how it can play out when it comes to our queer dating lives?
So I would say rejection is a sensitive topic overall, but I noticed throughout, like from my personal experience, but also from my clients, that within our community, within the queer community, the rejection is even like a harder topic because growing up, we all, like the first person who rejected us growing up was us. So growing up, we denied, we were like in denial, we were rejecting like part of ourselves, like an important part of ourselves. So when we start dating and we start like try, like even after we accept ourselves, since we haven't really worked on the trauma that this like inner or internal rejection caused, or even outer rejection, like from the community. I mean, even if like rejection doesn't have to be very direct and it doesn't have to be obvious for someone to feel rejected, just like growing up, feeling different than the people around you, feeling that people might not want you anymore. This is a very like a valid point, like form of rejection or feeling rejected. So growing up with that and having these lingering effects since our childhood, since we started noticing like, oh, maybe I'm different. Then when we start dating or even in our like social life, then like we perceive the smallest thing as rejection. So more than others, like, so we're more sensitive to rejection or anything that could be interpreted as rejection than like heteronormative or heterosexual people, because we don't have these tools to identify what is actually rejection, what is like actually should be interpreted as rejection and which shouldn't be. So even if somebody just says like, oh, I'm sorry, I cannot go this weekend because I have plans with my friends, that could already feel as rejection, even though it's not meant like that. But because we are very like highly sensitive to that, because of the suppression we grew up with, whether it's internal suppression or external suppression.
So we might internalize something as being a rejection, even though the person who might say, you know, hey, I've got plans with my friends next week, they're not rejecting us. Their intent isn't to reject us, but we may potentially see it that way, interpret it that way. Another thing that you tend to deal with are toxic relationships. And the word toxic is such a potent word that's so used, you know, currently in modern day times. Toxic masculinity, toxic this, toxic that. So when it comes to toxic relationships, can you give me some examples of behavior, actions that could be interpreted as toxic? And then how do we deal with that when we find ourselves in a toxic relationship potentially? Can you give me some examples first?
Sure. One of the very, very common examples is the emotional roller coaster. So the fun ride, which is really hard to spot because, you know, when you're having the highs, so when you're going up the roller coaster and this, it comes in the form that this person is showing, like showering you with affection, giving you lots of love and like being there for you. And then suddenly you have the lows and then you just think like, oh, this is just happening now. This person is in a bad mood. They are going through a rough time. I should give them space. But actually, if this is like being repeated a lot, like if you find yourself having a lot of highs and a lot of lows, kind of in an equal rhythm or equal frequency, then that's one of the signs to start questioning, am I riding a roller coaster or is it just actually just like part of life? I mean, of course, life has ups and downs, but not when there's a difference between life ups and downs. So like if you're having like a hard time in general, but if it's kind of happening on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, that these like highs and lows, and there's like a huge difference between them. So like one day you're feeling over the moon with this person, and then the other day this person is like being very distant. This hot and cold behavior can be one of the very telling sign, like for a toxic relationship. I mean, the person who's doing that might not be like a bad person, so don't get me wrong, but maybe they're going through their, like, they have their own issues they need to work on. There are stuff that they need to focus on, and they're just
not verbalizing that, if they aren't necessarily saying, hey, you know, I'm dealing with some stuff, so, you know, so give me some time or give me some space, or, you know, bear with me. If they're not necessarily saying that, they're just acting out, it's obviously they're a little unconscious of what they might be doing.
Exactly. So, you know, just like not knowing what someone is going through or going through a rough time is still not an excuse to treat people badly. So that's one of the things I would say, like, about toxic relationships.
And how do we deal with that then? How do we, is it something that we leave? Is it something that we stay in, we try to manage? How do we deal with these sort of things? Because we all deal with variations of this.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the questions to ask, or one of the things to observe, is when you and your partner going through a rough time, just ask yourself, like, how they're reacting to it. Are they still being there for you even if they're going through a hard time? Are they being distant? How are they treating you? Are you a team when you're having a hard time, or are you just being like dealing with it on your own? Another thing to observe is, do you feel like this safety feeling? Do you feel safe with this person? Do you feel they are there for you? Because more likely than not, if you don't feel safe, or if they keep you on your toes, or you feel like you cannot say what you want to say in front of them, like you're walking on eggshells around them, these are usually signs that, like, then you should start questioning that. And how to deal with this then is, first of all, open communication. So always talk about if you have any concerns, anything you have, like, you're experiencing. You should just go approach your partner and have open communication, because also that would give you a lot of insights, like how open they are to this conversation, how they're communicating about that. That also usually tells you whether this person is like dealing with it well, or able to work on this, like, even if they're not aware of that, but if they they're receptive and they have a positive reaction to this conversation, then it could still be something that you could salvage. But even if the communication is being really bad, or your partner is not being receptive, then I would then start for the first while to really prioritize yourself, like do the things, say the things that are prioritizing your mental health in the first place, and give it some time, of course, like don't make rash decisions, because maybe the other person is actually going through a rough time. And also follow your intuition. Your intuition, in the circumstances, play a big role in that. So patience, communication is always key. Intuition, and asking yourself and your partner the hard questions that you are trying to avoid. If there's one question that you're trying to avoid because you think it might upset your partner, ask that exact question, because it will tell you a lot of things, and it will also give you hints about how to proceed.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
So, as you may know, Rainbow Country is an award-winning gay radio show that's heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as a podcast. The broadcast outlets that carry Rainbow Country are listener supported. They rely on donations to help keep the lights on and the airwaves broadcasting. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of Rainbow Country, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry this little gay show. How can you do that? Well, simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and hit the donations banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that broadcast Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support, especially for independent queer radio, heard.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
So, Lane Halloum, you are a therapist, correct?
So, it's more like a practitioner, coach / practitioner, I would say, depending on the country and regulations and all of that.
Well, for this next question, let's go with the word therapist.
Yeah, sure.
So, you are a practitioner, you are a therapist. When you need to see a practitioner or a therapist, who do you turn to solve your issues? Who does the therapist see when the therapist needs therapy?
That's a very good question, actually. I would say therapists, or actually anybody who is working in the personal development sphere, they always have to have a therapist because
you need to go crazy.
I mean, maybe yes. But I would, so depends, right? Depends on whatever I'm feeling. So I do have like a couple of friends that they're also RTT, and then we sometimes exchange sessions if there's something we want to work on. Or sometimes I also go to like traditional therapy methods like CBT and so on, but depending on what I'm dealing with, if I feel there is something that potentially could have a deeper layer to it, then I will go to a therapy method or a therapist that deals with the subconscious mind. But if I feel like there's something I'm dealing with right now, like a difficult situation that I'm dealing with right now, and I need like kind of immediate help, then I would consider something with the conscious mind. So, but the best kind of therapy, in my opinion, that I wish it more people have these skills, like combine these skills, is having tools to deal with the subconscious mind as well as the conscious mind. And some, like, so far I haven't met so many people who deal with both and they have the expertise to deal with both at the same time. But that's why I try to combine different methods. So I go to different people when depending on the issue I'm dealing with.
So how did you get into RTT, Rapid Transformational Therapy? How did this all start for you?
Actually, it was after a breakup. So my first relationship, the breakup, it really destroyed me. And I realized during the breakup, I realized that I'm shattered beyond just like missing my ex. It was something deeper. I felt there was something deeper I need to find out. Also, during the relationship, a lot of behaviors or reactions came from me that I didn't recognize. And I realized there are insecurities that surfaced, issues that I was unaware of. And then I started following different like coaches, therapists online, like watching YouTube videos and so on. And then actually a friend of mine, she told me about Marissa Peer, so the founder of RTT. And I started watching her videos online and it really resonated with me. And then I started buying these self-help courses from her. And I got one or two sessions from like RTT therapists. And it really changed my whole life, and I uncovered insecurities and things that I had in from my past that I completely forgot about, like consciously. And then that's when I realized, you know what, because I was always into mental health and psychology, but I didn't know what I want to follow exactly. And then when I experienced that and the effect of RTT, I realized this is my calling, and I really want to also learn that so I can also spread this method further. And yeah, that's when I, like shortly afterwards, actually like a year later, I was already in the course and studying RTT.
So when you found yourself in that relationship and then you broke up and it really, you know, broke your heart and sent your life in a whole new direction, essentially, from where you are today, looking back on that time, how do you see yourself? Are you able to, the patterns that maybe you were in, that you were thinking, and the behavior that you were part of back then, do you still do those same sort of things, but you're just conscious of when you're doing it, or you've stopped that behavior that, you know, maybe you were doing during that relationship, what have you? Were you able to just like stop all of that?
So
I'm not sure if I'm making any sense.
No. I think I understood, like, the patterns I was following during the relationship, or these insecurities that
exactly
came up. Am I still doing them sometimes, but aware of them?
Exactly. Because for me, I truly wonder if patterns and habits and, you know, our mental issues, when we are in therapy, because I've done therapy, and I truly wonder if these things go away 100%, or is it just the fact that we become aware of them, and when we find ourselves potentially in one of those patterns again, we're able to consciously say to ourselves, okay, I'm doing this, let me calm down, let me take a minute, as opposed to never doing those behaviors again. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I totally like agree. So I would say, looking back, most of, like, a lot of the things I was dealing with or the things that came up, they actually stopped. So now, for example, when I'm doing something and like in my current relationship, for example, like if I'm having an argument or something comes up and then I just automatically react differently to how I was reacting in the past. But then, you know, I still remember, like, then I surprise myself sometimes. I'm like, wow, I really reacted differently now. And then other times, like, depending on the circumstances, depending on how deep you actually worked on a certain insecurity or limitation, let's say, or trauma. And sometimes, yeah, like when it's something about to happen, then I become aware of it. And then I'm able to, like, step back, take a breather, and then react differently. So really depends on how deep I went with, like, working on each specific insecurity or each specific pattern, and also depending on the circumstances. So it's very different. So there's no one answer. So yeah, exactly. So there's no one answer. And the sad thing is, like, why we see a lot of, like, relapse when it comes to therapies and so on, or not, like, 100% satisfying results, is because, I don't know exactly why, but or, like, why these therapy methods are constructed this way, but a lot of the traditional therapy methods, they follow, like, they work with the conscious mind. No, even though, like, even in neuroscience, it's known that 95% like, of our life or our mind is governed by the subconsciousness, not by the consciousness. So I feel like we should be working with the subconscious mind more than the conscious mind. And I think this is where, this is, like, the gap, that's, like, the bridging between conscious work and subconscious work. It's lacking right there.
And you talk about how healing the subconscious mind is a game changer when it comes to queer people and feeling stuck. So how do you, because this is, when I first read that, I'm like, okay, but then I'm thinking to myself, if something is unconscious, if you are not aware of, you know, your patterns that you may be doing, how do you become aware of something that is invisible to you? So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the unconscious mind and become conscious of your behavior? How does that work?
So by going back to, so it depends on the person. Some people, they recall memories that they remember consciously, but when they are in this, like, meditative state, then they experience or remember these memories from the past from a different, like, a deeper perspective. And then some people, they actually recall memories that they have completely forgotten about. So the idea is, when the conscious mind is relaxed, then it is easier to recall memories from the subconscious mind, because all of our memories are there. They're in our heads, even if we don't remember them. So getting into this state of meditation, this relaxed state, it helps to recall these memories. And then, whether you remember these memories consciously or not, when you experience them in that, like, deep level or deep state of mind, and then you remember many of them, so we go back to not just one or two, so we go to three, four, sometimes even five, and there are also even more tools to go back to the past and really uncover, dig deeper and deeper, uncover everything that could be connected to the limitation that you're experiencing today. And when you form, like, when you see this as a pattern during like one session, and then you see like, oh, that makes sense. This feeling is connected to this feeling from this memory and from this memory, and it is also connected to how I'm feeling today when I'm experiencing this and that. Then when you gain this understanding, it all makes sense. So RTT is built in a way that it's tools to help you navigate your own mind to gain the understanding that you need, to gain this aha moment that will help you release this limitation. So unlike, so I like, nobody from RTT would come to you and tell you like, this is your problem and this is what we're going to work on. So maybe you come with just a feeling that you don't like, that you keep experiencing, or a persistent thought, and you want to know why does it keep happening to you, and it limits your like one or more aspects of your lives. So it could be as simple as that, and then you uncover what's behind it even further.
So dealing with the clients that you have, which tend to be, you know, queer individuals, people that are part of the LGBT community, are there issues that come up time and time again that you see?
Yeah, so self-sabotage is very more common than I wish it was. self-sabotage, like chasing emotional unavailability, internalized homophobia, and yeah, I think these three are the most common things that I have experienced so far with my clients. And of course, like a sense of self-worth, it's also affected, but sense of self-worth, where it comes like low sense of self-worth, it's coupled with almost all of these, like chasing emotional unavailability, internalized homophobia, or self-sabotage. So these are the main topics that I actually have dealt with so far.
And when it comes to your practice, what are some of the challenges that you face when it comes to the people that you see virtually?
So sometimes I face skepticism. So because when people hear about hypnotherapy, then they're a bit skeptical. And this skepticism, sometimes it makes it a little more difficult to open up and like access memories. So I had to find certain protocols and tools to really navigate through that. So that's one of the main things. And then another thing is like this fear of losing control, because when also people hear like hypnotherapy and so on, then people are like, no, we don't want to lose control, we don't want anybody to control our minds. But I have to reassure everyone that it's not like the magic shows that you see on TV or something. It's just really, if you've ever done meditation, it wouldn't feel much different than that, basically.
And when it comes to your practice, what are some of the most gratifying things that you take away from some of your clients?
So I would say, basically, when you see like someone gaining this aha moment, and you see that they're really like starting to turn their lives around. And so the main thing that I like to give my clients before finishing from my programs is like a re-established relationship with themselves in the first place, because we always tend to project outwards. So the first thing that we need to work on is the relationship with ourselves, because if that's not good, then none of the relationships in our lives are going to be healthy or good. So when I see the way they start, like, because I always like I have this transformational journal that I give, and with different sections, and then they keep tracking over the duration of the program and even beyond that. And then they, when they go back, when we go back to it together, and they see, and I see like also how they start talking to themselves differently, how they, the thoughts that come up, the challenges they face are different, and the way they deal with the challenges are different. And when I see that, then I feel like, okay, you know, I've done my job. And it also gives me like, sometimes, you know, like they share, like my clients share different perspectives, and it also gives me insights into my life. And sometimes it's, it can be also therapeutic to me, even though I'm the one helping the other person, but it's kind of like, it's most of the time it feels like we're helping each other actually. So I would say this is most of like one of the main things that, that comes to mind when you say, like when you ask me this question.
Well said, well said. Lane Halum, well said, well done, well therapied.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much too. And I'm really honored and happy to have this opportunity to be here. And yeah, and looking forward to maybe more collaborations in the future.
That was my spotlight on queer relationship coach and rapid transformational therapist, or RTT, Lane Halum. For more information, simply visit rainbowjourney.co.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. From the 2019 Canadian film, The Last Porno Show, the track is The Last Porno Show.
Hi, I'm Joey Lamar, best-selling author of Mambo Lips and Salsa Hips, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.